You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to Weekly, the show where we recap the week for you. Supporters of the Eurogamer website get these episodes every Friday, whereas everyone else listens from Monday. You can find out more about supporting us in the description below. I'm Bertie, a longtime writer for Eurogamer, and joining me today are Editor-in-Chief Martin Robinson. Hello, Chief.
Hello, sir.
And Features Editor Christian Donlan. Hey, Chris.
Hiya.
Let's jump straight into it because we've had a big, glitzy, essential rated game come out this week. And Martin, you reviewed it. It is, of course, Xenoblade Chronicles 3, a JRPG masterpiece, according to you. Tell us about that.
Who said that? I can't hear. Who would say something as dim as that? But yeah, I absolutely loved it, as I tend to like and perhaps even overrate some Nintendo games. But it's a big, beautiful thing. It's been most of my life for the past month now, because it's a big, a 50, 60-hour game, which is no small feat to fit that into an average adult working life. but thankfully, I've really, really enjoyed every single one of those hours. It's an absolutely beautiful game that follows on from Monolith Soft's Xenoblade Chronicles Trilogy. It's the third game, but also kind of the fourth. There was a spin-off called X, which sadly never made its way to Switch, but that's a different story altogether. And it kind of builds upon all the things that are wonderful about the previous games in the series and consolidates them all into one standalone package, I think it's probably worth.
So what are the things that are wonderful about the series?
For me, when the first one came out back in 2010, it was all about the scale of it, I think. It was about these big, impossible alien worlds. Originally in the first game, you're kind of, the world is on the back of a fallen titan, and so you're kind of traversing this huge beast, and so you start off at like the base and then you move across its back, and it's just this incredible fantasy world. It's one of my favorite places to hang out in video games. It's like up there with the Mushroom Kingdom and Halo's kind of ring worlds. It's just an amazing place to just chill and hang out. And PlayStation Home, which is the best place. Chilling on the deck with Kaz, which is another thing I love to do. It's the worlds, basically. That's what draws me to them. It's this sense of scale and these huge landscapes that you can just get lost in and just go for big, long adventures in. I love that sense of possibility when you're looking out across from a clifftop. And you can just see all these little crevices and see all these little like mobs of animals you might go and hang out with. You can see a big level 80 monkey that's going to beat the crap out of you if you really want to go and start a fight with it. That's what I love about JRPGs more than anything. It's got all these other elements as well. And some people love it for the story. Not many people love it for the combat, because the combat's not its strongest suit. But for me, I love it for the world and the world building and just the sense of being in another place entirely.
One thing, you mentioned the combat there, one thing that jumped out to me in your review was mention of auto-battling. So you can set, from what I understand, your team to kind of automatically fight monsters for you. How does that work? Because I'm not sure I quite understand it.
It's basically putting the game on autopilot for you, which I think has become a feature in a lot of modern RPGs, which is really welcome, I think, for more time-pressed people like myself. Like, there was a time when I was able to put in hundreds of hours into one of these games as opposed to mere scores of hours. And sometimes it's nice to have the option, basically, just to switch off. when you're grinding out levels and everything, you can just basically put on autopilot, it'll fight for you, and you can just kind of sit back and enjoy the numbers going up and enjoy, for me, what is where the real game is, which is just about the exploration and being in this other place and kind of unpicking the story and stuff like that. I like the fact you can kind of dial down the combat as much as you desire, basically, and make it kind of a more of a peripheral part of it.
I see. So you still watch the battles. They're just being played for you.
Yeah. I think it's a lot of the kind of some of the remakes that have come out recently, re-releases, like I think in Chrono Cross, it was a thing in Final Fantasy, in the versions of the PS1 version of that come out again, you can do it as well. it just makes it a lot more palatable, basically. Not that there's, I do love the JRPG combat, and I almost feel like people might get upset that, like, why didn't you play the combat? You didn't play it properly if you're not getting fully engaged with it. But I say it's just nice sometimes to have the option to dial that down and get to where, for me, the appeal of the game is, which is in the world itself.
Yeah, there are definitely moments in all kinds of RPGs where you're up for doing the fighting and really tinkering and changing things. And there are moments where you just want to sit back and kind of breeze through an area. So I wanted to ask as well, I haven't played a Xenoblade Chronicles game. I've always kind of intended to, but as often happens, the games kind of pass you by and then they're forgotten. So can I jump into this? If I haven't played the other games, will I be missing anything?
No, not at all. Like, they do, all three of them, all four of them, including X, are standalone stories. The numbered games do have a kind of, do have recurrent themes and do have things that, like, they are in the same world, basically, and they do kind of come together, but it's in such a loose way that I don't think you're going to miss anything if you've not played one before. It's almost like, you know, like a Final Fantasy game is, basically. You don't have to have played Final Fantasies 1-7 to play Final Fantasy 8 or 9 or whatever, because they're all independent things with shared themes and shared attributes, like Moogles and Cactors and stuff like that.
Chocobos,
and
Chocobos,
yeah. See, you know, you're a JRPG expert. Xenoblade is kind of like that. It is a lot like that. And part of me worries that kind of the number might be off-putting to some people, because you see that and you're like, well, I haven't played the first two, so why am I going to jump in now? But it's a standalone thing. And in fact, I would highly recommend it to you if you've not played one before, because it does a very good job of, I say it's almost too good a job of onboarding you, since the onboarding takes quite a long time. But it does a very good job of explaining to you how this world and how the systems work.
Well, consider me interested then. Digital Foundry's John Linneman has also done a deep dive on the technical performance of this game on Switch, as Digital Foundry does, and he says it pushes the tech to the next level. He seems very impressed with it. Also in reviews this week, we had Edwin taking a look at another JRPG, but this is an old Squaresoft anthology, Live Alive, I think I now know it's pronounced. And this is an anthology kind of based around the thrill of side quests, from how I understand it. And he gave it a recommended. Martin, I seem to remember you knew a bit about this game from before.
Well, I knew it's one of those kind of legendary games that never got a full Western release. I think there was a fan translation going around of it, but I never made the effort back in the day of downloading ROMs and getting the fan translation. So it's kind of one of those legendary games you hear about. The director, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head because I'm useless, it is a game he made for Chrono Trigger, which is widely heralded and recognized as one of the greatest JRPGs of all time. It still stands up incredibly well. Like, I love going back to play that game again. It does things which other games have never really done since. Its combat system is just incredible.
Oh, I love Chrono Trigger. I've never played Chrono Trigger. I love Secret of Mana, but for some reason, I never got to Chrono Trigger, and I keep wanting to go back to it. And I was actually researching this a little while ago, because I suddenly felt the urge to play it. And there's not a particularly good version of it available.
I've got it up there. I'll bring it in next minute. There's a DS version, which is pretty good.
I've got the DS version.
Yeah, I think it's probably quite expensive, and I think actually one of the reasons I've got it out is because I was looking to eBay it. But before I do that, I am happy to lend it to you. I think it's probably the best way to play it. It is overdue a kind of a more modern release, so we can play it on modern hardware. But if you've got a DS hanging around or a 3DS,
I don't. It's a good way to play. I got rid of it a couple of years ago. Sorry.
Oh my god! How could you?
I know.
Unbelievable. I think I've got a handful of them. Don't worry.
So in Features Land this week, Christian, you have been roller skating around. I think you have roller skates and not rollerblades. Just in your house, in your hot pants. No, in a game called Roller Dome. So tell us about this.
Roller Dome. We did briefly call it Roller Dome on the website in a headline. but yeah, just think Videodrome and roller skates. Which is a great combination. It's really it's the new game from Roll7, and it's coming out really soon. It's like, is it the 16th of August or something like that? It's out before you know it, and it feels like it was only announced quite recently. It is Roll 7, probably most famous for making Olly Olly, but they also made some wonderful games like Laser League and Not a Hero, a sort of arcadey cover-based shooter, which is just very hard to describe while getting across what's great about it. And this is a single-player roller skating and shooting game. So you're on roller skates and you're shooting people. It reminds me a little bit of Robotron in that it drops you into these arenas where there are enemy types who are very predictable, gameable approaches. So there'll be snipers and there'll be sort of grunts who sort of try and hit you with clubs and things like that. And you have a handful of different weapons. It's just wonderful. It's really, really, really good. I've got to play through quite a bit of it, and it's a treat. It's lovely.
They're so prolific. This is like, well, not getting ahead of ourselves, but it sounds like this is going to probably review quite well and be another incredible game. And it doesn't seem that long ago that Olly Olly Worlds came out and was another incredible game. Like, they've got two games of the years in quick succession.
I think it is the 16th of August, by the way.
Thank you. I think what's interesting about it is how it builds on almost every other game they've ever made. It feels like a combination of, like, they've taken stuff from Olly Olly. Obviously, it's got a trick system. So very quickly, the thing that's really ingenious about it and that should make you want to play it is that you regain ammo by performing tricks and you regain health by killing baddies. So you're constantly pulled back into that sort of combat or being stylish sort of frame of movement. And it feels like they've taken a lot of stuff from Olly Olly and a lot of stuff from Not a Hero and a lot of stuff from Laser League, the sort of the way you move around and stuff like that. It feels like they're pulling all of that stuff in to make the Roll 7-est game ever, but while bringing something really new. The sort of convergence of it will bring something new. And the art style is really interesting as well. It's very sort of 70s. It almost like 70s French comic book art is probably, I mean, Mobius is sort of the touch point, but it doesn't actually, when you're looking at it, doesn't actually remind me that much of Mobius. It's just sort of, it's extraordinary to look at, and it's a lot of fun. Yeah, I'm excited for it.
That's great. They're such an amazing studio. So I don't know. I always feel like I'm not sure if I am biased towards them because of they are a New Cross team originally.
And you're so quite they're friendly with them, aren't you, Martin?
Well, so it was many years ago. We got an email into our kind of anonymous tips thing, and basically someone just emailed in saying we're making a Vita game in New Cross, and I was like, oh, I live in New Cross or near enough, and I'm a hipster enough to think the Vita is an amazing machine, so I'm going to go and see them. And so I went to go and visit them. This would have been like 2015. And they were just, like about six or seven of them working in this really scruffy office at New Cross, making the first Olly Olly. And so it was amazing to go and see them then. And I like saw it. It's like, wow, this is actually pretty special. And it's been brilliant to see kind of, I feel privileged almost to have been able to see the journey from there to here. Now they're kind of a fairly big deal. But also just most importantly, their games are just incredible.
And what we were talking about, you and I were talking about when we were looking at Videodrome for Rollerdrome. God, my God, we're never going to get this name right. Rollerdrome for the right.
I wish is James Woods in at any point with like a
gun around it. Yeah, he is, but sadly, it's the contemporary James Woods rather than the original.
Oh no!
When we were looking at Rollerdrome, we were thinking like they have never actually repeated an art style. All of their games have had a different, even Olly Olly 1 and Olly Olly 2 have very different art styles. Obviously, Olly Olly 3 does as well. But they've never repeated an art style. I love that. They're sort of constantly moving, constantly evolving things. It's lovely. What a team.
Yeah, that's because their games all look very different. But you can pick up a controller and you can know by the feel and by how tightly designed they are. They're instantly like recognisable.
They talk about flow. They were like, I was getting the impression because I interviewed two people who worked on it, and I got the impression that flow was how they defined a Roll 7 game. But I think it's the same coin, but the other side of it. I would say it's expressiveness. It's you have that ability to express yourself within the restrictions, the energizing restrictions of the game. They also said something super interesting, which I didn't get into the piece. I was talking to the head of QA, and they were talking about how QA are playing the game right from the start, and you really get the sense that they use QA as a lot of teams use QA, as you feel like more teams should use it, not just to sort of look for what's broken or like when dip points where you sort of slide through the floor or where things stutter. They were just like, they were like, oh, this particular way of playing is OP at the moment. So one of the things I was doing, you get a lot of ammo for kiting a sniper. The sniper target comes onto you, and then when it goes from red to white, that's when they're shooting. And if you dodge at just that moment, you get a load of ammo back. And I was like, oh yeah, I've been kiting snipers and it really, really works up until the point where it stops working. And they were like, yeah, we've made sure it stops working. And that's because QA just play this game for hundreds and hundreds of hours. And they're not so much looking for it to be broken. They're just looking for things which are slightly off in the balance. It was really interesting, really great.
I'm looking forward to playing it. So you've also, this week, you've been playing GTA Online, whereas your wife normally plays it. You stole the controller from her, or more accurately, when she walked into the other room, you picked up the controller, and you decided to jump into a paper trail. I think it's called a paper trail mission, which is one of these new missions. And yeah, turns out you're gifted at the game.
No, I'm absolutely terrible at it. Turns out. Absolutely terrible at it. But what I thought was really interesting was that, so A, I get really stressed whenever I have to write about GTA. I don't know if that's just me, or I don't know. I just feel this crushing.
Is it because you're expecting, you just feel like in the old days, you'd fully expect an email from Rockstar about 2 days later saying, why have you said this? And then you're, yeah, like, how dare you make it?
It's more like A, everything has been said about that game that will ever be said. But B, that game is super complex. Like the things it's sort of, its meaning is really complicated and contradictory and difficult and brilliant and all of those things. And you feel like you have that entire legacy to sort of disentangle. So what I really did was I played one, there's 5 or 6 new missions in this new update to GTA Online. I played the first one and yeah, I had an interesting time and it left me with so much to think about that I was like, I can actually just write this up. Yeah, but my wife is double dangerous in GTA Online. She's extremely good at it. And I am.
So will you get a chance to play any more of these missions, or is she like, look, stop it, you're ruining my cred?
She doesn't play the missions, actually. She doesn't play the story missions in GTA Online. She just sort of, she does
loiters.
Other... it's like properly her playground. She sort of, two or three nights a week, she sort of disappears into that world. It's made me really appreciate the game. I don't think I thought enough of GTA 5 until it became my wife's favorite game. And then you just see a different side of it. But no, I don't think she's drawn to the story stuff in it. And I don't know if I'll go back, but that's only because I have to go on and do other things now. There's never time to kind of come back. But it was a really interesting experience, and I wrote it up, and I, in a way, I'm quite anxious about it. But it's out there now, so hooray, it's done.
too late saying about it now. It's been a good week for GTA, I guess.
Of GTA, I spoke to a guy called Gary Penn, a couple of weeks, but we put it up this week anyway, in a long podcast that's nearly 2 hours long, which is available to subscribers at the moment or supporters, but will be available to everyone else in a couple of weeks. So that's coming soon. And Gary Penn, if you don't know, well, firstly, he's known for being one of the writers on Zap 64 years ago and a magazine called The One. This really personality-led, maybe for the first time back then as well, magazine with Julian Rignall and other people like that. And then he did a lot of publication stuff and then sort of slid over into game production. And eventually this ends him up at DMA Design in Scotland, which is the company that had made Lemmings and was then making a game called Race and Chase, which would go on to become Grand Theft Auto 1, of course. And what was so interesting hearing him talk about it, that DMA had loads of games at the time. And of course, Grand Theft Auto didn't exist. There was no legend there. There was no specialness or anything like that. It was just another game in development. And by all accounts, was kind of awful. It didn't work. It was so buggy. You could play it for very long. It didn't feel very nice to play. And they're trying to juggle all these projects. And it's nearly getting canned every week. But various people fight for it. And eventually they put a new driving model in the game, which suddenly changes everyone's opinion. It suddenly becomes quite fun to play. And more people can see what this thing is going to be, and then it starts to come together. So he's talking about the kind of origins of GTA. Just imagine what it would have been like if that game had never come out. I mean, would another game have just come and filled its place, or would games have been taken in a slightly different direction? I don't know. Anyway, Penn stayed at Rockstar until sort of GTA 3 was just started development. Apparently it was supposed to be a remake of GTA 1, according to him. He was working on Manhunt, a sadistic hide and seek game as he knew it then. But he got fed up of Rockstar. It wasn't just Rockstar by the sounds of it. He had, from the days of Zap 64, been instilled with this kind of hardcore, not even hardcore, but unhealthy work ethic, which was just work all the time, basically. Work That's in and out, outside
the,
of work.
The Rockstar way. And well, obviously, there's the report from the brilliant report from Jason Schreier about how they've kind of mellowed. But that's very much the Rockstar way then and until quite recently, is to basically just overwork people to the point of it seemed like quite a grim place for quite a while.
Yeah, so he, this style of working, which had been, encouraged, if not demanded by Rockstar, just became too much for him. And understandably, it's unsustainable. So he wanted out. And then he joined helped create a company called Denki, which is a company he's been at for 22 years now, which is kind of remarkable that a company has been around that long anyway. It made interactive TV games 4 years and then scaled back. And more recently, it made Quarrel, which you might remember from Xbox Live Arcade, also mobile. And it made Autonauts, and a new Autonauts game comes out today, actually, Autonauts versus Pirate Bots. And it's a game about kind of automating a settlement, but this time also defending against pirates. And apparently it's quite well liked by various people. And it's not supposed to be educational, but teaches the kind of fundamentals of programming almost unwittingly. But yeah, it's got a following. But that was a lovely chat with him. And he's really interesting to talk to. He's got a great way of thinking about things and sort of picking them apart. And I guess as designers sometimes do, veers off on tangents about, what things are as he's picking them apart and things. And seems just like a very nice guy. So anyway, I wrote a big piece about that. And also the podcast is available. Before we go on to the GTA 6 stuff, which we'll come to in news, which Martin said, I also wrote a piece about another old game, Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance 2, which has been re-released this week. And I was playing it. I missed the original, but its legacy obviously continues. It was the sort of D&D console crossover that kind of helped all these other ones appear, and it's an action RPG and stuff like this. But one thing has been bugging me for days about this now, and that's that it's £30. Actually, it's £31.49 on Xbox, and I cannot get my head around this. How anyone, even if you love the series, even if you're Imogen, who used to write for us in Rock Paper Shotgun, and wrote this wonderful piece about how her nan taught her how to play Dark Alliance 2, which is just this lovely, heartwarming story. Even if you love the game, this is an 18-year-old game. £30 for a remaster that just about works, but basically makes the game playable on today's console. It's just too much. It's ridiculous. I've paid
in excess of £400 for a game which is a lot older than that, and you can't even press continue on it anymore
puts it into perspective.
I was wondering why your reaction to it is so.
I think it's too much. I think £15 or £20 is for a game like this fine. But you're like, this is the same price as a lot of new games. I think it's opportunistic pricing.
It's interesting that sort of that you have an idea of what the price should be. I think that's
price is
a
tricky topic.
Yeah, and I feel like it's very interesting that in your head there's like, oh, this is what I would pay for this.
I do agree. It is an eye-opening amount for an older game on a digital storefront. It does stand out, basically.
That's the thing. I think normally we don't talk about price because it's the sort of expected price. But when it's too much, often, then when it's like, hang on, what? That's that reaction I think I'm getting, which is that hang on, what reaction. Anyway, like the game itself is boring. it's old.
That's why you're so upset about being £30.
It's just old. Right? It's
your reaction is starting to make a bit more sense now.
It's old and boring, but I don't mind that so much because I think it's like that's what it was. That's where it was in history, and I found it fascinating to look at it as a piece of history, because it holds. It was also the last game that Black Isle made before it was closed by Interplay. So it's got all this it's got all this interesting historical kind of context around it, and I think you can feel it as you're playing it. So yeah, it doesn't stand up at all by like today's standards, but that kind of isn't the point. Anyway, I won't dwell on that. So also quickly in Features Land this week, we had a couple of State of the Game pieces. One of these was for No Man's Sky, which is now 6 years old, and it's had 20 updates. And I love, we had Matt Wales writing about this, who's kind of played it on and off for those whole 6 years. I love the way he sticks with games like this. And I really admire the sort of determination Hello Games has had to stick with this game and overhaul it, almost change it. Maybe it's an obsession. Maybe it's a reaction to the launch, which was obviously problematic for various reasons. Maybe it's an obsession that they have to see this game become something in its own right. Regardless, this game has completely changed from being this game where you kind of flit around without really looking at what's going on, all this procedural universe stuff, to one where you find a corner of it, you make a base. It's more of a base building game now, where you make a base and you can do so much in it. From the way Matt was talking about it, you can like breed animals, you can be a pirate, you can do a different thing every day by the sound. So it doesn't sound like that in depth, all these different things that you can do, but there's this huge variety of it. And another thing that I love about games like this is that now that the stampede of people that was kind of welcomed and enticed in the hype has gone, the kind of what's grown in its place, almost like these sort of plants through the cracks left, is this community which is really positive about the game, really welcoming, really helpful. And so this lovely thing has blossomed in its place. And it really makes me want to play No Man's Sky. But this write-up is wonderful.
I wouldn't go that far. But that's taking it. That's too much. But I love it as well, because I was one of the early believers. I'm not sure a lot of us were, and like bowled over by the initial reveals and even when it first came out as well. I think we were a lot keener on it than some people, because it had that kind of, it had that eccentricity and it had that expansiveness, and that was already there, the important stuff. But I think the crazy thing is that even when at the peak of its hype, basically when Sean Murray was like, he was on like US talk shows and everything, and being profiled as if it is the biggest thing. Even in the context of that, it's got much bigger. The game's become more than I ever imagined it could be, even from the perspective of like the hype that was laid on it at the time. Obviously, it's moved on from that hype and it's become something else, but the game itself has evolved into this. Just, it's incredible. It's wonderful to see, say, how they've stuck with it, how they've kind of pushed through some of the rockier bits as well. Yeah, I think they've done a phenomenal job. And also just that community is just wonderful.
It does make me wonder slightly what else Hello Games is doing and where the money is coming from, because they don't charge for a lot of it. They're very generous in that respect, I think, with the updates that they're giving them. And 6 years of post-release support is a long time. So I don't know what's happening there, but
they've got lovely offices now as well. A lot of lovely. I haven't been there for a few years. But yeah, they are doing phenomenally well off of it. I'm sure it's ticking over quite nicely for them.
The other State of the Game piece we had this week was on Hearthstone by Edward Hawkes, which is 8 years old, which is also surprising. I remember being the first time I went to visit CD Projekt Red in Poland, I remember playing the Hearthstone beta, and I was so excited. I was telling everyone at CD Projekt Red about it. I was like, you've got to play this game called Hearthstone. And then they made Gwent. So effectively, I created Gwent. I didn't create it. So Edward Hawkes is obviously a fan of the game, and there's so much to like about it. But what brings this game down, in his opinion, years after, is you have to pay so much money in it to stay competitive to it. Otherwise, you become like obsoleted by the new stuff that's coming in. He's saying that you have to spend something like, well, at the lower end, something like £70 a year just to keep up with this game, and then you can spend loads more on top. I loved his quote at the end, which was, while it's still among the best CCGs in the business, Hearthstone just doesn't know the value of value. Mike
bosh.
So we'll see what's coming. It's 8 years old, you know, come up with something new. Talking of something new, Diablo Immortal was just made they put out a new financial thing for it. Apparently it's made $100 million in something like 8 weeks or wow. something like that. So clearly I'm still playing it, but that's clearly that's doing well. A quick look at Digital Foundry this week, and they've got, and you could only get this on Digital Foundry, it's a mammoth multi-part retrospective of the PlayStation 3, written like a year-by-year account of the PlayStation 3 and how it got on with 1080p gaming, basically. I like, it's one of these Digital Foundry at its most Digital Foundry. So
PS3 is so big now, right? Like, a lot of it, because Digital Foundry obviously does really well out of the retro stuff as well. But it's the interesting thing now is obviously PS3 is retro, which makes me feel incredibly old. But PS3 is having a bit of a moment, I feel like. I've got a bit of the limelight being shone on it, because it was such a weird machine. Yeah. It's the last kind of truly weird console. I mean, Nintendo still did the Wii U, which is weird. But the PS3 was just, it was Ken Kutaragi at his oddest but also most brilliant. It's a strange, fascinating thing.
I kind of like that this big, bizarre, hubris machine is now kind of, it feels it feels safer now it's in retro territory, because we can sort of look at it without going, oh come on, you know, you're really up your own what's it's now, Sony, come. But now it's there, you can look at it as this bizarre sort of experiment. And anyway, this is part three that Rich is writing. There's another part coming up. They literally are taking it year by year and just looking at everything and how this system sort of lived, which is, and looking at it in the kind of depth that you expect from Digital Foundry, which is brilliant. Over in Videoland, Zoe finished her recap of The God of War lore that we were talking about last week with Ian, and she's continuing with her Spooky Madison playthrough. Ian and Zoe got really scared playing this game Devour in VR. Ian streamed the Hitman 3 new DLC, Ambrose Island, and there's a nice picture of him photoshopped onto some guy's body for the thumbnail. Not that that matters. And Ian's also taken a look at all the stray Easter eggs, just in case, you know, you want to go through that game again. And why not? Because you can mod all sorts of things into it now. Like, you can mod your own cat into it. Someone was taking commissions to mod their cat. You can mod Garfield in it if you want to have Garfield in it. You can mod dogs into it if you want to have a dog where you should have a cat.
That's too far.
It's all a bit
too much.
So over in Newsland this week, Martin mentioned it earlier, but Jason Schreier at Bloomberg did a big piece on Rockstar and Grand Theft Auto 6. And the headline kind of takeaways for that was that this new game is at least a couple of years away still, and it will star a female protagonist alongside a male protagonist in a kind of Bonnie and Clyde double act, and will be set initially in Miami, but expand to take in like huge chunks of both North America and South America by the sounds of it. And the underlying kind of part of this, or the reason why it's going to take another couple of years at least, was, as Martin mentioned, that the company has mellowed. But another way of looking at it is maybe that the company has grown up a bit, or like sophisticated. I don't know if that's too harsh, but Dan Houser has left, and he used to lead development on the games. And I think he was probably indicative of the old school way of making games at Rockstar. So maybe now it's got new leaders. They're focusing more on basically the work-life feeling for staff, I think. So they've got new producers in to make the workloads more manageable. They're doing things like narrowing the gender pay gap. There's flexi time working. And so as a result, the game is taking longer to make. But maybe that's not a bad thing. There's also things like, apparently, you know, they're not going to punch down to marginalized groups and things. And I wonder when the new game comes out, if this kind of stuff is going to be quite, you'll be able to feel and see this game like it's a new approach, a new style of GTA. I wonder how tangible that will be when we're playing the game.
Well, I guess because there's such a, it feels like there's like an ice age in between Rockstar games, and you have felt that. Because the first Red Redemption felt like a more grown up, Rockstar game. GTA 5 less so, but then Red Dead Redemption 2 obviously was a bit more mature, a bit more grown up. So it'd be interesting to see how it lands when GTA 6 finally arrives and everything. It's obviously good they've had the changes there. Dan always struck me as the more relaxed of the pairing between him and Sam. Mm. But I never met Sam. I interviewed Dan many years ago, and he seemed a bit more laid back, whereas Sam is the one that you hear stories about some less than savory stories about. But you know, it's good that they're taking their time with it. Obviously, a game of this scale cannot be rushed, and just good for the people who are working on it as well, because of it's sometimes you again hear stories and it doesn't seem like the greatest place to work. So I'm just pleased that they're taking their time and looking after themselves, basically.
Yeah, shame that sometimes the biggest games, so the games people want on their CVs as game makers, these games like Grand Theft Auto, The Witcher 3, and Parsive, are these games that, you know, really push people harder and actually are not very nice to work on. So anyway, let's hope that's changing. Jason Schreier was also behind another report this week into the Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic remake, which is the game that I love, the original. And apparently it's in, quote, serious trouble, quote, and has been, quote, delayed indefinitely, which to me reads like it's been binned. The problem seems to have come, apparently, they were all pushing 3 years they've been making this for a vertical slice on the game that they presented to Lucasfilm and Sony, who's the publisher, at the end of June, to which they turned around and were like, it's not where we want it to be. And apparently it really wasn't, like, it would have taken years more to make. So they fired the game's art director and design director. It seems harsh, a dark side harsh. And now the game is, and then they put the game on pause. Like, to me, that game's never coming out.
It was, to me, I've not that I'm really like, oh, I told you so or anything, but like, but from the moment it was announced, I could never see this game coming out. Like, Aspyr, the studio behind it, a fantastic studio who like made their name doing Mac ports for games for the Mac. Good job, they've done a great job doing that, and have done some good support work and everything. But then all of a sudden, they're like, we're going to do a AAA remake of this huge, expansive game. It's like, how? Because if it's not, it didn't seem like it was towards their expertise and everything. Like, how are you going to all of a sudden turn this studio that's known mostly for porting stuff into being able to take on a project of this size? It never seemed feasible. And so it was really upsetting news, but not surprising.
I'm kind of pleased in a way. Remakes like this, I don't know, I have some issues with, because there's a lot about Knights of the Old Republic. It was a great game, and it is a big game in terms of the importance it has in Star Wars and for BioWare and things like that. But it's quite old and boring. If you play it now, mechanically, that game's not great. It's got a memorable story, I think, is what propels it still forward. So if you bring that into a remake, you can't just reskin it. You're going to have to sort get in there and give it stuff to make it more fun to play now. So, and that starts to become a really tricky thing. So in a way, I'm glad it's all still left in its older packaging.
I've gone back to it, like I'm sure we all have. I've gone back to it a few times in recent years because it's one of my favorite RPGs. It's probably my favorite Star Wars story of them all. It's just such an amazing thing, but it's dated. It's really hard to play now because of a lot of it has dated quite a lot. And so it is still ripe for that kind of modernization, just to get that story and those characters out there in a modern format. But yeah, I don't know if it's going to ever happen.
Yeah, we'll see. If you want that kind of thing, Star Wars The Old Republic, the MMO, has tons of stories like that, but then is equally held back by an aging, creaky MMO kind of base underneath. But elsewhere in news, and this was brilliant, a secret church was found in Nier Automata, or Automata, I don't know how people pronounce it, via a secret door. 5 years, I think it's 5 years after it was initially released. And this is a game that's kind of known for its secrets. So this is immediately everyone's like, this is some crazy secret. And I love that in the tweet that kind of circulated this discovery, there were the words, so far no one else has worked out how they managed to make this secret door appear. Literally one person on Earth has accessed this room, and we are utterly mind blown. This is someone from the Reddit community saying this. I just love that this is a thing, and it feels like something that could only happen in Nier, or maybe like a Fumito Ueda game, but Nier. I just love this, and also love that the developers Yoko Taro and Yasuki Saito sort of waded in on Twitter, but neither of them confirmed anything. They were as cryptic as the discovery itself, so much that Taro said, quote, I love sausage and beer, quote. Brilliant.
That's all. It's better than no comment. The story has moved on, I think, since significantly in the last few hours. I think it's so. I think it's become clear that it isn't a secret in the original game. It's a mod has done it.
Okay.
Or it's using. It's also using assets from the Nier remake, which came out last year. And it's either a modder who's done it and has done a very good job of it and is like been set and got everyone really, which is still cool in itself. There's potential that it could be a marketing thing for there's a new version of Nier coming out on Switch later this year. And so there's, but then
we've been hoodwinked.
But I love Square Enix. They make some amazing games and they've got a brilliant slate of stuff coming up over the next few months. I don't think Square are smart enough to have done something like that for this, or not smart enough. They're very smart. They're not switched on enough, and they wouldn't have been able to get it together for a marketing beat. So I don't think that's the case. I think it's a modder who's done a really good job of like getting the story together.
Hire that modder,
like stringing people along. Yeah, 100%, totally. But no, but it's been fascinating. It's just amazing as well. It's just brilliant to see. When communities are drawn to this and what they've done with it and unpick it and everything, it's lovely to see this kind of clue chase that everyone's doing together, this big mystery.
If you are Yoko Taro and assume this isn't a marketing beat for the game coming up, but how exciting for you to wake up and then see this spreading on Twitter and go, this is so cool that my game has taken its life so much of its own that people take it upon themselves to create like an elaborate ruse like this or something. I'd be impressed if that was my game. I haven't made a game.
I think it's really interesting as well in terms of how stuff gets into things, how stuff gets into games. I mean, it looks like this is if this is a mod, that's one thing. But like, it reminds me of, there's a really famous, obviously I'm going to talk about Moby Dick now. There's a character who's introduced in Moby Dick with some fanfare called Bulkington, and then he just doesn't do anything. So he's introduced in an early chapter and like you're like, oh my God, this guy, I'm going to pay attention to him because something is happening here. And then nothing happens. And sort of the idea, the kind of current idea about him is that he was going to be more significant in an earlier draft. And then his stuff got cut out, basically, but he's still introduced in this elaborate way. And he's sort of a ghost of a different journey within the same text. And I think with games, you see that sometimes. You see like, oh, this corridor is here because of this or that. And it doesn't go anywhere because we decided to move away from where it was going. And I think it's lovely to see that sort of mixture of like intention and sort of spookiness.
Was it you who wrote something similar about this, about Rhyme, the game that changed quite considerably? It was like a Zelda alike, and then it became more of like a platformer.
No, I didn't. I can't remember that. I love Rhyme. Rhyme is a wonderful
game. Anyway.
But that makes a lot of sense. But yeah, it's super interesting. And like there's a famous door that you can't get through in Super Mario Sunshine, isn't there? At the bottom of the dentistry level, there's a door at the bottom and you can see through it, but you can't get through it.
Only Mario has
these doors as well. There's a lot of doors like that in games. Bloodborne had a door like that as well, which no one could open for it. Everyone was...
Oh, yeah, that's right. And they proved that it was like a brilliant shortcut. They put coins underneath it. Yeah, no, and doors are just fascinating. Like I'm always fascinated by the fact that cats attach all this meaning to bringing Stray in here. But like cats attach much more meaning to doors than humans do almost. They bring things and they drop them at doors. They'll leave... When they bring you like a gift, like a dead frog or whatever, they'll put it by a door. They have a big thing about thresholds. And I think there is something kind of quite interesting about them. We're pretty kind of wired in some way to sort of find them interesting.
There were lots of doors you couldn't get through in Dragon Age 2, incidentally. But they were literally bricked up because they used the same level design over and over again and just changed it by literally bricking up the doors. Anyway, moving on. The Lord of the Rings Gollum game was delayed again. Probably because Gollum's off trying to find the ring. No? No takers.
You lost me.
You lost me as well. Yeah.
No, the Gollum game was delayed for what sounds like more polish. It's been pushed back from the 1st of December by, quote, a few months, quote, though we don't know exactly what that means yet. My bet is probably March 2023, but we don't know. Elsewhere, World of Warcraft expansion, Wrath of the Lich King, is launching again this September for World of Warcraft Classic, 14 years after it first came out, as you do. Oh my God. The PlayStation Plus Essential lineup for August has been announced and includes Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 and 2, which is a remaster and is considered very good. There's a thing on Digital Foundry about this where John Linneman gets very excited about it. Also in the lineup are Yakuza Like a Dragon, which is not the strongest Yakuza game from what I understand.
Oh, it's the one of the best.
Oh, didn't we? It's one of my favorites.
Oh, sorry, I'm getting a phone call. Sorry, can I disappear just for a second?
You can.
He can go. No, I can't remember what we gave it. I can't remember what score we gave it. Maybe we didn't, but I personally, I don't want to. I really like it personally. It's a turn-based Yakuza. It's the start of the new direction for the series. For free, it's worth it.
Consider my opinion changed then. And the other game is Little Nightmares 1, which of course is that really evocative side-scrolling horror game that lots of atmosphere, looks like these plasticine models and lots of world building as these kind of monsters, kind of fleshy monsters ooze around. Very good, well worth checking out. So that's this month's PlayStation Plus games. Elsewhere, Ubisoft has said that Roller Champions isn't getting cancelled, just in case you were worried, because there was a rumour circulating that it was. Also, the Nintendo Switch Online app now finally lets you send friend requests, which I've never been bogged down by before, but that sounds like a big problem. And
I've
if
got
you're
no friends, so it's fine.
Well, yeah, likewise. And also, 1440p monitor support is coming to PS5. Air horn. There's an Annapurna showcase happening tonight. We haven't seen it yet, but I've had a look at some of the announcements that are coming. And some of the things you should look out for are a new look at colorful and energetic Thirsty Suitors from Outer Loop Games, which is coming next year on PC, Xbox. It does look brilliant. I think that's going to be one of the games next year when it comes out. There's apparently a new kind of Dino Crisis style game called The Lost Wild. Sounds a bit like The Lost World, which is a first-person survival horror in a Jurassic Park-like dinosaur-infested jungle. It doesn't have a release date. It's made by Brighton-based developer Great Ape Games, apparently, who I'm not actually aware of, even though I live in Brighton. New game from the creators of Hohokam, Flock, is apparently in the showcase. And it's got these vibrant alien worlds, which apparently are sort of like underwater worlds, but in the sky. So you get like flying whales and shoals of fish and stuff. And it's multiplayer co-op. Apparently that's very eye-catching. And then some other little bits like Keita Takahashi, the Katamari Damashi creator, revealed the title of his new game, which is Uvula, or Uvula. Uvula, I don't know.
I'm learning this all first time. This is all brilliant.
Yeah.
Is Uvula the thing that hangs down at the back of your throat?
Yes, I think so. It's not the.
A friend of mine has two of them.
Wow. Don't they bang into each other?
They do.
That must be annoying.
I gather. Well, he's never known any different, though, so he's fine with it.
Kentucky Route Zero developer Cardboard Computer is working on a new game that we don't know the name of yet, but apparently we're getting a tiny glimpse of it, and we see some lively animations and a comedy, and there's a cute animated dog. Like, who knows what that's going to be, but it'll probably be quite good. The new game from Irish developer Dreamfeel, which is the team behind the transgender narrative game If Found, which is really well regarded, is going to also be set in a sort of fantasy version of Ireland, and it features cats as well.
Am I allowed to say this? This sounds so much better than everything that was announced at every.
It does sound
showcase.
Good, doesn't it? And the game's going to be about coming together in the face of adversity. Again, quite a lot like If Found, but it sounds great. And slightly sadder news: Emmy award-winning actor David Warner passed away this week. It wasn't in many games, but he was the villain in Baldur's Gate 2, John Irenicus. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly. But yeah, a legend of screen and stage. So sad to see him go. That's everything.
I'm laughing because of the way you said it. Obviously, I am sad to see him go, but you said it in quite a funny way. And then I found I was laughing at the announcement.
That's everything for this week. Sorry, we've run a...
He was great in Twin Peaks.
A little late for everyone there. But thank you very much, Martin, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Christian. I'm Bertie. That was Weekly, and we will see you again next week. Bye for now.